From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
Here's a different voice. Here's a different way that Judaism is looking at your life and at what you've gone through and who you are now. And maybe I can provide an alternative perspective, an alternative voice, another way of looking at things. But the first thing I have to do is say, I hear you.
Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum is a longtime New York City faith leader, activist, and educator. She has served once before on the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, and President Biden has announced his plans to return her to this important body at a time when both Judaism and LGBTQ plus persons face growing dangers in many parts of the world, often in the name of religion. I'm looking forward to having Rabbi Kleinbaum back with us on this week's show.
There are going to be some people who are just unwilling to listen. It's a small minority of people. I think it's kind of like there will be some people who always believe in the subjugation of women in the home and in the church. And those people are probably not going to move on LGBTQ issues either. But a surprising number of evangelicals, I find, are moved in their hearts to support us and just need a little help getting there theologically.
Discussions continue among more progressive faith leaders and activists regarding how to end the barbaric practice of conversion therapy. Survivor testimony is certainly a key part of any strategy, and a new book makes a particularly compelling argument. Julie Rogers is the author of the powerful Outlove, a queer Christian survival story.
The nation's founded on principles of freedom of religion and freedom from religion. The government has got to be free from religion, because if it's not, the first thing that happens is one religious sect will gain control over state power and oppress everybody else.
All too often, the precious religious freedom enshrined in our founding documents is being misused to promote a white nationalist theocratic vision for our nation. This Wednesday, Interfaith Alliance is presenting a free online event titled Freedom of Nonbelief, Secular Leadership, and Religious Freedom with U.S. Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland. Alliance President Jack Moline will be here with details.
I'm Ray Kirstein, reporting from the intersection of religion, politics, and more politics. The political religious right continues to get in bed with election deniers and others committed to undermining our very democracy. The Mike Huckabee-fronted My Faith Votes is disseminating overt fake news, most recently in the form of an email blast trumpeting the findings from something called the Public Interest Legal Foundation. Yep, a far-right mechanism to use our legal system to shatter trust in our legal system. Claiming that 15 million mail-in ballots in the long-ago settled presidential election were, quote, unaccounted for. What's harder to account for is a well-funded, religiously titled, tax-exempt outfit with the slogan, Equip and Activate Millions of Christians to Stand for Biblical Values, blatantly undermining public trust in the very system it relies on for its lucrative existence. Meanwhile, Texas Freedom Network is sounding the alarm about the latest batch of public school textbooks under consideration by the State Board of Education there. Some texts under consideration claim that Moses was central in the drafting of America's founding documents, slavery was only peripheral to the Civil War, Islam alone is the driving force behind international terrorism, and the LGBT movement was a symptom of a society spinning out of control. Texas is so large that books approved there tend to spill over into a number of smaller state education systems. And GiveSendGo, a Christian crowdfunding website, has added yet another person charged with taking part in the January 6th insurrection in our nation's capital to its approved projects. A defense fund for InfoWars on-air character Owen Schroyer joins ostensibly Christian fundraisers by neo-fascist hate group Proud Boys and the 17-year-old killer from Kenosha. GiveSendGo calls itself the, quote, number one free Christian crowdfunding site. I wonder what causes number two is enabling.
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. You can do it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, we thank you for it. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now, to our first guest. Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum has been leading Congregation Beth Simchat Torah in New York City since its founding in 1992. Recognized as the largest LGBTQ plus synagogue in the world, CBST offers education and leadership on many essential issues facing today's world. And so it's no surprise that Rabbi Kleinbaum has been doing the same for decades, including her time on the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. President Biden says he wants her back on that commission, and he's far from alone in wanting that. And I welcome you back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's always wonderful to talk to you, and I'm the president of your fan club. I find you one of the deepest thinkers about religion in America today. So thank you. It's an honor for me to be with you today.
Well, thank you, Sharon. When did you previously serve on this important commission?
So Senator Schumer appointed me in December of 2019. So I began in January of 2020. So I was only on the commission for a couple of months when COVID hit. And here in New York City, those first few months of COVID were terrifying and very difficult. We went into an immediate lockdown, of course, and our illness and death rates were off the scales. And as a congregational rabbi, I just felt that I couldn't fulfill my responsibilities to my congregation, which was in total crisis with illness and death and fear and anxiety, and also serve on the commission as fully as I thought it responsible to do. Mm-hmm. So I stepped down in April of 2020 so that I could really focus on my congregation and on our COVID crisis here. So I was very honored when the president approached me about being reappointed for this new term, which will go till May of 2023. Mm-hmm. And of course, I accepted when things looked like they were really going well. Back in June, 20 years ago in June of 2021, and I'm hopeful that I will be able to do this position with my current congregation. And I have a 6-month sabbatical for my congregational work, and I'm doing some projects during that time, and this will certainly be one of them. The United States Commission on International Religious Freedom has kind of a multi-level agenda. One is to, on behalf of the president and the Congress and the State Department, to be able to be a little bit of a watchdog and aware of what's going on internationally. And the focus is international. This is not a focus on domestic issues, with the prism of religious freedom. And then to make reports back to Congress and the Senate and the House of Representatives and President and the State Department on thoughts about what's happening in a whole list of countries related to the issue of religious freedom. There is no other body in the United States who has that responsibility. And as you know, President Biden cares very much about human rights, and he cares very much about religion. So I think under his leadership, the commission will really be able to do wonderful things. I don't yet know when travel will begin again to those countries, so I'm not quite sure about the travel part. So the commission does hearings and works with Congress and brings in experts like a congressional hearing would look, and does it in order to develop a annual report, which is issued in May each year, analyzing various countries that are on different kinds of watch lists and with the expert staff of the commission, develop a report that recommends to our government how we should look at these particular countries based on their track record around issues of religious freedom. And it's complicated.
It is complicated.
And so that, and by the way, the website is a fabulous place for anybody who cares about international issues related to religious freedom. It's USCRIF.gov, USCRIF.gov. And it has the annual reports listed. Some of the hearings that USCRIF does are open, and now with Zoom, you know, how easy is that? Fantastic to participate. You know, and it'll do just issued press releases about issues about religious minorities in Afghanistan, for instance, and Northeast Syria, and Muslims in China. So it's a very, very, very exciting place to be right now. And since so much of my work as a congregational rabbi is dealing with religious issues here in the United States, I'm very excited to be extending that and learning more about our international world.
There's no question that the political religious right in this country has been expert at harnessing well-intentioned programs and agencies in the service of a narrow vision of
exactly.
a theocratic world, as they wish it to be.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
The Commission on International Religious Freedom has been no exception at times.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's less of a concern right now? And if so, why?
Well, the commission is a bipartisan commission. And as such, it reflects some of those partisan issues. I'm pleased that it's bipartisan, by the way, and I'm mm-hmm. happy to serve with people whose views are quite different than mine. And the atmosphere and tone is, by and large, very collegial and focused on this. But, for instance, the chair of the commission when I joined was Tony Perkins,
mm-hmm.
and he still serves on the commission. And I actually really respect him and like to be in the room discussing these issues with him. Because if we can't sit down and discuss them and try and work out some understanding, then there's no hope, I believe. So I'm very pleased to be there with voices that are very different than mine. And honestly, voices whose understanding of religion completely diverges from
yeah.
my own. And he's still on the commission. So the commission does reflect the party of the president in office. So it's now a majority Democratic with a minority Republican, and that switches back and forth. So, yes, there's always that tension about how religion will be used. And we know religion can be a source of great liberation, mm-hmm. and it can also be a source of great oppression.
Sharon, I can tell you, and you're not going to be surprised at me saying this, why I want to see you in that position again. And
mm-hmm.
it's because you understand the meaning of religious freedom.
Yes.
Do you see part of what you need to be talking about?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
As somebody who's fought, for instance, about LGBTQ rights,
mm-hmm.
and what happens at the intersection when religion, one's religious views might have a different take on LGBT rights. So I've taken a position that I think is deeply rooted in the First Amendment and deeply rooted in my Bible,
mm-hmm.
which is that I respect and protect and would fight for the rights of my Catholic priest friends down the block or my Orthodox Jewish friends down the block to not do a same-sex wedding ceremony in their church or synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
That is absolutely their fundamental religious right to not do that. However, they don't have the right to codify that into law.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's great about our country is the separation of church and state. The Catholic Church has not advocated, for instance, that anybody who is divorced cannot get a civil license to be married in the United States, which is correct. And I respectfully disagree with them when they say, therefore, because they religiously don't believe that same-sex couples should get married, that should also be a civil forbidden civilly. Of course not. That's a separate issue. And so I believe very strongly. And I also know that there are limitations on religious freedom. Even in this country where the First Amendment is quite clear that religion is protected both in the Freedom of Religion Clause and in the Establishment Clause. But if I were to say my religion tells me I should sacrifice my firstborn daughter, that's not legal in this country. We have understood if there is a compelling state interest on the part of the country to say some things cannot be done even in the name of religion, and yes, the state has to prove why, that's legitimate. It's not okay for me to say it. I think part of my religious practice is to pick up an Uzi and go down to the supermarket and shoot people up and say that's a religious practice. Of course not. So where there is tension between religious practice and some individual freedoms, like the freedom to shoot people or the freedom to kill a child for sacrifice, there are limits, like there are limits on all of our freedoms in order to live in a society. And that becomes the question that we have to approach with nuance and with careful respect. What happens at those intersections? And they require a lot of conversation and a lot of thoughtfulness and a lot of consulting with scholars. But I believe that there is a way to resolve them. And in this country, it's been a very complicated story. And largely, we, over the course of hundreds of years, have found some path through. But that is where it becomes complicated now. It's a very big issue in the United States right now about LGBT rights, trans rights, et cetera. And by and large, the Supreme Court, up until now, has very narrowly issued court opinions. And so this is something that we're very concerned about here in this country and outside. We run a clinic at CBST, an immigration clinic, that helps asylum seekers achieve asylum in the United States. And one of the big issues on which we help is the for those who are fleeing countries where being gay is punishable by death or persecution. They're coming to this country, and many times the countries they're fleeing are persecuting those gay people based on, I believe, misreadings of religious text, but it is their religious, these are religious texts. So you, sir, for example, has started to take positions when religion is used to oppress or, in fact, even kill gay people, that that's not okay.
Intersectionality has become a bit of a buzzword, but in this case, it fits perfectly. So many assaults on religious freedom today are impacting Jewish and LGBTQ plus persons in particular. Talk about the identities that you bring to this role and to this moment, if you would.
Absolutely. I am the only Jewish person on the commission. There are two openly gay people, and I'm certainly obviously the only rabbi. So I certainly bring a lot of sensitivity to the issues of anti-Semitism in the world as it now exists, and we are watching anti-Semitism explode across the universe in a way that is breathtaking. And likewise, there's also been a lot of confusion about when is it possible to be critical of Israel, and when is that criticism anti-Semitism? And there's some very serious and very good discussions about that. And I think I bring to the commission a lot of sensitivity about those discussions and a lot of nuance about how to approach it. So I'm very grateful to be in that position to help think that through. And obviously, as an openly gay person, I'm able to also bring sensitivity because the intersection, as we've talked about, of LGBT issues and religion, honestly, that's been a hot-button intersection for a long time. I often say that LGBT people have experienced different kinds of persecution. Yeah. One is that the medical or psychological world has called LGBT people sick. Criminal justice systems or law enforcement have called us criminals. And religion has called us sinners. And some societies, in America is an example, we've made tremendous headways about medical, you know, pathology of gayness being removed from the DSM, et cetera. And we've made a lot of headway about changing laws. But one place in which anti-gay, I'd say kind of the tsunami is growing strength, is from right-wing religious groups. Mm-hmm. And they are forming, strengthening, I think, those opinions. And we saw it under the Trump administration kind of fostering that hatred a little bit, even more in, among some right-wing religious groups of all persuasions, by the way, Jewish, Protestant, Catholic, and it exists as well in the Muslim world, yeah, in the right-wing world.
Sharon, when you look at the shape of our world is in right now, I wonder, where do you draw the energy and enthusiasm that you need returning to this commission?
Yeah.
Where are you finding hope in taking this on?
Well, I think we've all learned, despite the pandemics, in some ways separating us into so many small atomized apartments and homes and universes, we've also learned by this, you know, the spread of this virus, how deeply connected we all are. And there are many lessons that I think they're out there to learn from the virus. And one of them is how easily our breath carries things to each other. Mm. And the virus is an example of how much we can infect each other so quickly with disease and with hate. We've seen this likewise. Social media is a little bit like the pandemic, the viral infection of our souls and our hearts. Well, I believe the opposite is true, too. We can actually uplift each other as easily as we can infect each other. We can bring light as much as we can, you know, make despair and grimness our shared world. And I'm very moved by those who are stepping up right now, joining this government, trying to figure out ways to see some successes so that we can spread that, mm-hmm, the breath of light rather than the virus of such sickness.
You know, the last time that you were on the show, we were face-to-face in a New York studio.
That's right.
I wish we were today.
Yeah.
But I'm really...
Generations ago.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you brought up the pandemic, because I'm sure it has impacted your work and, mm-hmm, your congregation. And I'm glad to hear you see... or say there is something ahead of us that may be good.
Yep. I agree. I think that's the moral lesson that we're given, you know, and we've often quoted in these days, the Book of Esther says, you know, for this moment you were born. And if we really believe this, that for this moment, if you're alive now, you have something, each of us has something to offer the world that is desperately needed, then whatever it is that the world is, if we're here, we have something to offer it.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep saying to my folks and to myself, honestly, as much as anybody else, none of us can do everything, but all of us can do something.
So we see how it impacts you as a minister. Does this have any impact on the work of the International Commission?
Well, certainly. First of all, very practically, it's very hard to travel. And the part of the commission is to really go in delegations to all these different countries to meet on the ground with religious communities, with government leaders, with activists. And so on a very concrete level, it's not been possible to do that kind of travel yet. And I'm hoping that will change. So it's for sure been impacted. And like everybody else, meetings have been held largely virtually, although we're scheduled to have an in-person meeting in D.C. in September. I'm hoping that will still be in person. We're waiting to find out.
Do you know a number of the other members of the commission? Have you worked with them?
Some of them I have. Some were on the commission when I was last on it for that brief time. And Kazir Khan. He's the appointee along with me, the Muslim father of
a great
the Gold
guy.
Star family. Yeah, great guy. So, look, I don't know him, and I'm really looking forward to working with him.
Yeah. How do the members of your congregation handle this?
Well, I think they're very proud. People are concerned about, you know, how will I manage the time issues, which I'm also concerned, of course, how to do it well. And honestly, there's been some very right-wing attacks on me, which has come from the right-wing Jewish community. And they've been quite ugly, and I think people have been very concerned about some of those attacks. Unfortunately, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Our communities have become, and they're using it as another way to attack the president for having appointed me to this position.
What would success during your tenure on the Commission on International Religious Freedom look like? What do you most want to achieve?
Well, I think a really visible expression of what progressive religious values look like on an international level also. You and I know that many countries have as their only definition of religious values a very right-wing, narrow set of interpretations, dogma, prayer. And I'm hoping as I'm the only progressive religious leader, you know, as a Jew in this context, to be able to open that up a little bit more, to be able to acknowledge it's not that religion is oppressing people in some places, but that let's understand there's a variety of religions and that we have to care as deeply about the Muslims in China as we care about the Christians in Syria, as much as we care about the Jews in places of oppression. How do we expand our picture? I care very deeply about it, not being only singly focused on a particular group, but that the practice of religion is a profound one.
We also now are having to look at being justice-oriented to people who are not religious people.
Exactly. And to reflect that and to show we don't need to we need to act in ways that reflect God's presence in our lives. It's not always a lecture.
Yeah. How do you define religious freedom?
I define religious freedom, first of all, the USERF itself, the commission itself, obviously looks to the International Declaration of Human Rights as a source to look at international issues. But I do believe that every human being has the right to express and to practice religion and their relationship with God and to practice no religion. Religious freedom to me also includes the right to be a non-believer and to do it in a way that respects other people as well. And that's what's complicated for some religious definitions of religious freedom. We live on this planet with a lot of people who are quite different than each of us. And I believe God wants us to respect those differences, B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God, each of us is created, not just one type, not just one religion, not just one race, not just one gender or gender expression or sexual orientation.
Yeah.
So to reflect God, I believe we have to start from a place of respect and learn and go from there.
Sharon Kleinbaum is the founding rabbi of Congregation Beth Simchat Torah in New York City, the largest LGBTQ+ synagogue in the world. President Joe Biden has announced his intention to appoint her to the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. She's going into it with all that you've heard her talking about. And we're kind of making a decision that we'll get back together in about 6 months.
Okay, great. That would be terrific. I'd always love talking to you.
Well, Sharon, you've always been helpful to us, and I thank you so much for taking time to being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Blessings to you, your family, and all your listeners.
There's lots more still ahead on this week's show. Up next, Julie Rogers, author of the powerful new book, Outlove, A Queer Christian Survival Story. And later, Freedom of Nonbelief, Secular Leadership, and Religious Freedom. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. Today, Julie Rogers is known for several notable achievements, being the first openly gay person hired by an evangelical college, her prominent role in shutting down the ex-gay abuse factory, Exodus International, and now the author of a powerful memoir titled Outlove, A Queer Christian Survival Story. Featured in the Netflix documentary Pray Away, I am very pleased to have Julie Rogers joining us now on State of Belief Radio. Julie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for reading my book, engaging it, and having such a warm response to it. It means a lot.
On the one hand, it's great to have more light shining on this important topic. On the other hand, though, it must be awful to be reminded of how widespread this quackery still is. Would you start with a short description of your own experience?
Yes, so I came out when I was 16 years old to my conservative Christian family in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in Texas. And my parents loved me, and that was really clear from both of them immediately upon sharing. And then 1 week later, my mom pulled me out of school early and took me to meet with a man named Ricky Chalette, who's the executive director of Living Hope Ministries in Arlington, Texas, which is still going today. It's important to know. And they were essentially practicing conversion therapy in a religious setting, which is actually where conversion therapy primarily plays out, in pastoral counseling, in recovery groups, in settings that are more like, you know, youth group meets 12-step meetings. And I spent the next decade of my life involved in that ministry, trying to change, trying to be good, trying to be someone who made my parents proud, and trying to become somebody that I felt like could find acceptance and approval in my conservative community. It didn't work. And over time, I began to find that not only did it not work, it also was causing tremendous harm to me and to people I came to really love that were in the organization with me. A lot of friends who were struggling with self-harm and engaging in really just like destructive, self-destructive patterns to cope with the sense of shame they felt. And so that was what led to me kind of being a part of helping end Exodus International, because I just came to see that it was such a, it was an abusive practice, and it was ultimately causing so much harm. And the right thing to do is to just repent and to say, like, it's wrong, and we'll end it and we'll find another way.
Hmm. What are some of the harms that come from this kind of mistreatment?
Well, if you are led to believe that the way you're wired to love, that your sexuality is inherently broken and disordered, then you come into contact with that like many, many times a day, every single day. Sometimes when that's like a sexual desire you have or a crush, which is just part of the human experience that we all face every day, but also just in terms of like how we feel in our bodies, how we feel in our genders, to what extent we feel quote unquote masculine or feminine. Everybody in the group with me was just hyper focused on like, am I sitting gay right now? Am I coming off in a way that's going to make the people around me think I'm disgusting? And that was because that was what was at risk, that we were seen as disgusting and that we were repulsive. And it led to just a constant sense of anxiety, a feeling of shame that if people really knew me, they would be so repulsed by me. And the effect of that belief about your own self, your own body, the way you're wired to love, the effects of that belief lead to, like, self-harm was one of the most prominent behaviors among people in the organization, because we hated our bodies and we were, we took it out on our bodies. And we've also seen that research shows that youth who are subjected to conversion therapy are more than twice as likely to attempt suicide, to have attempted suicide in the last year. That's breathtaking. And that alone should be enough for evangelicals and Christians in any community to ask their leadership, hey, do we believe anything like this? Because if we do, I can't be a part of funding that and I can't come worship in a place like this. Mm-hmm. So suicidal ideation, self-harm, a lot of drug addiction, quite a few friends would sort of slip away in the night and ended up on meth. And it doesn't work. It's really harmful.
Yeah. Judy, what resources did you find that helped you move forward?
So it was sort of a long game for me. Once I realized that I couldn't become straight, I was like, okay, I have to be honest with myself and other people that I'm gay. But I was still so scared of losing my community that I thought, well, maybe I can just be single and celibate for my whole life and be able to stay and keep these relationships that are so dear to me. That's all I've ever really known, you know? And so for a couple years, I took that path and thought, like, I'll just never date or marry. And what moved me to just fully affirm same-sex relationships was ultimately seeing that teaching also caused harm, that anything that made people believe that the way who they are in their bodies, their natural intuition to give and receive love, that anybody that believes that's broken and disordered, it leads to shame. And so I was moved to support same-sex relationships out of care for queer students I was working with, seeing how much healthier it was for people to just be able to live out in the open, to date in community and to be seen and fully supported and loved and to feel wanted, to feel like they were actually a gift to their communities. That was the fruit of that was so beautiful. And ultimately I got to a place where I was like, even if I do lose all this community that I grew up with and, you know, don't have as close a contact with people like my family or former mentors, that's worth it because this is the path to life. And that's a road that leads to death.
How long did it take to get from where you started to what you're describing now?
So I was 16 years old when my mom took me to Living Hope. And I was there until about the age of 26 or so, helping end Exodus for that last year. And then I didn't come out in a place of fully affirming until I was 29, right before my 30th birthday. So I spent pretty much all of my teens and 20s on some sort of path of just like suppression and fragmentation and denial, you know, that was framed as sort of like the glorification of suffering, but it was a denial of self-hatred. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I was 30 years old that I could really come to a place of full acceptance and delight in who I am and who other LGBTQ people are.
A terrible side effect of attempts at LGBTQI plus conversion is the loss of faith that many people experience as they fight to simply survive. How were you able to not only continue as a Christian, but take on the role of a leader?
I have a real capacity for complexity and a sense of mystery that has served me well. And I really felt all along like God loved me, like God is for life and wholeness and human flourishing. And I just had a real clear sense that the people who were rejecting me and were, you know, shame, like creating such a sense of shame in me, that they were not reflective of God because they didn't reflect the spirit of Jesus. Mm-hmm. So being able to see in Jesus a model who showed such kindness and such compassion and such tenderness toward those who were pushed to the margins of their society, you know, women, lepers who were seen as unclean, people with disabilities, like all kinds of people, they were the ones that Jesus was really drawn to and had such tender places for. So I kind of felt like if that was how Jesus operated in, you know, the biblical times, then that was surely how Jesus would be today. And then Jesus would be our friends, that Jesus would be a friend of the queer community. So that really helped me hold on to my faith as a lot of pieces started shifting and crumbling in many ways from my old framework. Hmm.
You unflinchingly examine the conflict between American evangelicalism and the LGBTQI plus community. Julie, I can't see this conflict outside of partisan politics. Are there more charitable ways to nuance how we got here?
I think they're intricately tied together. And I also think that's at a leadership level. So I think that people like my mom are actually vulnerable and seeking to do the right thing. And of course she's, you know, driven by right-wing politics as well. But I really hold the folks like Jerry Falwell and James Dobson, Robert Jeffries, these people who are know what they're doing and are making such compromises of vulnerable people in the name of seeking wealth and power. So I think it is intricately tied together with right-wing politics, but that I don't think everybody in the pews necessarily makes that connection.
Hmm.
It's not to say they're dumb either. Yeah. I didn't make that connection. I didn't know, because it's such a closed circle that you're in. You're just listening to John Piper or Matt Chandler or whoever, and you're reading, you know, Oswald Chambers every morning and the Bible every morning, and you just don't know that there are other narratives and other stories and other takes on what's happening. And so I think there has to be some sense of curiosity about other viewpoints to be able to begin to hold them up against one another and say, where does reason lead us?
Yeah.
And you have to be able to consider other perspectives to be able to move on from it.
Mm-hmm. What ways have you found to engage people within the evangelical world on queer issues? What breaks through what so often looks like an impenetrable wall of exclusion and rejection?
I first have to see, like, is this a person or is this a community who is genuinely open, that is curious and interested in listening and that believes me when I tell them stories? If they are, I found that relationships are really powerful and people can see me and follow me and go, that's the same person that I knew and loved as a teenager or in her early 20s. And she does seem healthier now and she does seem more integrated and whole now. And I think that's powerful. I also think, though, there are going to be some people who are just unwilling to listen. And it's a small minority of people. I think it's kind of like there will be some people who always believe in the subjugation of women in the home and in the church. And those people are probably not going to move on LGBTQ issues either. But a surprising number of evangelicals I find are moved in their hearts to support us. And just need a little help getting there theologically.
Do you mind if I ask you if you would just give one illustration of the positive one? Because I think there are a lot of people looking for that.
So my wife is a business leader and she runs a marketing company. And she recently had a friend reach out after watching Pray Away, who is also a CEO, big businesswoman, who's an evangelical, a conservative evangelical. And she reached out to Amanda after she saw it. And she said, I think my church supports this. And I had no idea what was going on. I just thought, oh, it's a support group for people with same-sex attractions. Like, I didn't understand. And I'm so alarmed and I'm so appalled. And I'm going to write to the pastors and leadership of the church and ask them where they stand on this. And if they do support it, I'm going to tell them I'm leaving. Hmm. And I was so shocked at the decisiveness of that. Like, she saw truth. She saw the truth and said, like, I'm going to take an action immediately that gets at leadership, and I'm going to leave if they're not open to changing. And so that's one example among many that I've experienced over the years.
Well, thank you for doing that. Julia, are you hopeful that this chipping away can continue? Because I'm afraid powerful evangelical leaders are adapting to the arguments that used to work in challenging them and finding ways to dehumanize LGBTQ plus persons of faith with extreme versions of hate the sin rhetoric.
They are adapting. If you go to Living Hope's website right now, which is the organization I was in that practices conversion therapy, and I hear from people in the ministry all the time, they're doing the exact same things they did when I was there. But if you go to their website, they don't have any language anymore that would show you what they're doing. They're just like, we walk with people towards sexual and relational wholeness. And it's all really cloaked in terms that sound more accepting and affirming. And so it is really disconcerting to see these sort of rebrands going around. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think that by and large, you know, the statistics showed recently that younger evangelicals are actually leaving the church. Millennial evangelicals are leaving in like large numbers. Yeah. That gives me hope because they're the generation that's really growing up with people who are out in the church. Mm-hmm. Previously, people would come out and they would be kicked out. And then the leadership would lie about them and say they went into the gay lifestyle and they're on drugs and just like having sex everywhere and all in the streets. And it's just so debaucherous. And like, you're just like, no, that's Mardi Gras. That's probably straight people doing that. But they would lie about us and the people had no reason to believe anything different. Whereas now kids at Wheaton College who were there when I was a chaplain follow me and they're like, Julie was great. Julie seemed to like always have a safe space for me and was like the one person I could go to tell the truth about myself where I could find like actual like empathy and grace. And so I think that makes a big difference for moving on this issue. And I think we'll continue to see that in the years to come.
Would you talk about the community that you've built called Reimagining Belonging?
So I have a Substack, and I love the Substack. It's one of my favorite things I do right now. I write a weekly newsletter and host a monthly Zoom with people where, you know, I call it Queer Reflections on Faith, Public Life, and Chosen Family. And it's an opportunity to think about the ways that the LGBTQ community has, like, really crushes Chosen Family. And it really finds a way of creating long-term committed networks of people where we're finding intimacy in ways that I think people long for so deeply. We know that the narrative of like finding the one and settling down and having kids is not one that's going to satisfy relationally long-term. We have such deep needs for intimacy that go far beyond what one person can really do. So I'm loving just getting to imagine different forms of friendship, different living situations, what it looks like to recover a robust faith and a more expansive spirituality on the other side of a process of loss of faith in many ways. And so it's fun. It just feels experimental and exciting to be have a little space on the internet to get to work things out.
Hmm. What are some of the other resources that you refer survivors of ex-gay therapy to?
I would right now say go to Pray Away, the documentary I'm in that's on Netflix. Go to Pray Away's website because they have a ton of resources and they have done a more recent job updating the resources than I have. There's always new communities that people can pop into, but I would say their website's going to be the most helpful at the moment. Mm.
I want to tell you, when I first said to myself, we've got to have her on State of Belief, and here's why. It was when I read the first page entitled Author's Note, And you wrote, quote, "It's really hard being human." Now, that may sound kind of interesting to you. Several decades ago, I wrote a book entitled A Soul Under Siege. That was a book in which I was coming out with reflections and memories of very severe depression. But that depression was also a part of the references coming to me from evangelical journeys that I had been on myself. I could not confess that I was human. I couldn't be a Christian and human. When I read that from you, I thought, okay, she understands it. She saw it a long time before I could see it. And everybody that I know that listens to State of Belief needs to hear her story. Does that sound crazy to you?
That means so much to me. And it means a lot because I think so often people see me from my gay story. And it means a lot when people can really see that, yes, my orientation is a part of what's opened my eyes to so many things, but it's also given me a window into just like how hard it is to be human and the complexity, the sort of weight we're all wrestling with and how hard we try and how much we all suffer. And it means a lot when somebody can really connect with me over all of those different things that are so common to our humanity, as opposed to it just being this like unicorn over here with this other person with this weird story, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Where would you urge LGBTQI persons and their families to turn if they are struggling with questions around faith and around identity and how to be human? Where can they find faithful support that won't cause the kind of damage conversion therapies always end up causing?
It's a great question. There's a couple organizations like the Pray Away website has some resources to go to affirming churches all around the country. But there's also an organization called QCF. It's Q Christian Fellowship, which exclusively exists to serve LGBTQ people of faith and their families. And whether or not if a family wanted to plug in there, that would be amazing. I recommend it. But they could also just go to get resources from their local community. And they're going to have a wide network of people to get connected to so that people can know they're not alone.
What do you hope that everybody who reads that book comes away thinking about?
I hope everyone feels a little less alone. I hope everyone feels like it's a little bit easier to breathe. And like wherever they are in their journey of questioning or struggling, that they will feel a little less fear and a little more inclined to love. Mm.
Julie Rogers is the author of a powerful new book, Out Love, A Queer Christian Survival Story. Her story features prominently in the Netflix documentary Pray Away. Learn more about her work and leadership at julierogers.com. Julie, thank you so much for your powerful example, for your generous honesty, and for taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be with you.
While the political religious right continues to hone its skills at subverting religious freedom for all to advance its own narrow agenda, more inclusive and pluralistic communities are not sitting on their hands. We've seen a wealth of new resources and presentations highlighting the true meaning of religious freedom for all. And a key component of that is freedom for non-believers. This Wednesday, Interfaith Alliance is presenting an online event featuring the U.S. Representative Jamie Raskin, and Alliance President Jack Moline is here with a quick look at the details. Jack, thanks for doing this today.
My pleasure.
Freedom of non-belief, secular leadership, and religious freedom. What do our listeners need to know about this event?
Well, first of all, they need to know that the polling that's been done among a wide swath of American citizens indicates that among the 18 to 29-year-old age group, 36% do not profess a faith, and that among the 30 to 49-year-old age group, a quarter of them do not profess a faith. This is PRRI, our good friend Robbie Jones, who's done this polling, and it's authoritative. So what that means essentially is that we have somewhere between a quarter and a third of the rising generation of Americans and leaders who, I won't say they're not religious, that is not what that statistic means, but it means that they don't consider themselves to be part of an existing faith group. Now, that is a decision of personal conscience, which is, after all, what the First Amendment protects. It doesn't mean that all of those people are secularists or agnostics or atheists, but it does mean that they are the largest single cohort in this survey under the age of 50, and therefore we have to be concerned as Interfaith Alliance and as American citizens about protecting the same rights of conscience for them as we do for people who do profess a faith. Mm. And that's what this webinar is all about.
So what does Congressman Raskin bring to this topic?
Well, Welton, I think all of our listeners know him as a constitutionalist par excellence. Yeah. He's a man who knows the Constitution backwards and forwards and how it applies. He's the one responsible for the aphorism, when you take office, you put your hand on the Bible and swear allegiance to the Constitution, not the other way around. And so we know him as a constitutionalist. Most Americans now know him as the leader of the impeachment proceedings that took place earlier this year. People in the Jewish community are particularly proud that he comes from Jewish heritage, but he is one of those people who doesn't necessarily profess a faith. I think he'd probably describe himself as a free thinker. So when you put all of those things together, yeah, there's really no one on the national stage better qualified to discuss protections for people of all sorts of faith perspectives than Jamie Raskin.
Who else will we be hearing from?
Well, our listeners are all familiar with Katie Joseph, who is our Director of Policy and Advocacy at Interfaith Alliance, an extraordinary young woman who has a lot of great insights into this. And she'll be moderating the conversation with Congressman Raskin and with Mandisa Thomas, who is the founder and president of Black Nonbelievers. There's a group that a few years ago I don't think we would have even been looking for, but now they're a significant force in this space. And Kevin Bowling, who is the director of the Secular Students of America, a primarily campus group that gives voice to people who are in that 36% of Americans 18 to 29 who don't profess a faith.
Hmm. Well, tell our listeners how they can listen on Wednesday.
The easiest way, and when you talk about technology, I'm always nervous about saying the easiest way, but the easiest way is to go to the Interfaith Alliance Facebook page, click on the link that is in the advertisement, the slide, the posting that advertises this webinar, Freedom of Nonbelief, Secular Leadership and Religious Freedom. It'll take you right to the registration page, and you will get a reminder and a link as to how to view it. Or, if that's a little too complicated, and it is for me, you can just send an email to us at info@interfaithalliance.org, and we'll be happy to send you all of the information. Or the night of September 1st, all you ought to do is go to our Facebook page, and we will be broadcasting on Facebook Live.
Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, Protecting True Faith and Freedom for All. Jack, it's always good when I know we're going to get to talk.
My pleasure, Welton. All good things.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Thank you so much. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I would ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week. One person for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was.